Accession number 30493, reel 19.
My memory seems to have improved in my very last weeks in the army, which were, I was posted to Woolwich Barracks, and because I was an old soldier by that time, the sergeant major pounced on me and gave me a cushy job in the office, if I remember rightly. And I remember he rather disapproved of my reading, which at the time consisted of taking the Times every day, which I would guess he was thoroughly approved of, but I also took the Daily Worker. I was getting a very rounded picture of the politics of the day, I can tell you. However, he didn't stop me reading my papers of choice. But it was obviously a cushy time I must have had there. And the advantage was for me that I could jump on a train at night and go into town and visit the Old Vic, which was at the height of its season there, the Shakespeare season, with Laurence Olivier and Alec Guinness and all these incredibly talented people. And so for the first time I was seeing, I'd never seen a Shakespeare play, I'd seen Laurence Olivier in Henry V. Now, in Florence, now, I've only just recently discovered that it was, in fact, from my diary, that it was the first showing in Europe of Laurence Olivier's Henry V in Florence, and that's where I saw it. And it made a big impact on me, because I'd never seen a Shakespeare play before. And I'm not sure, I just no memory of Shakespeare at school either. However, from then on, Shakespeare really became a part of my life. No doubt about that. And seeing the Old Vic Company in their, what was called the New Theatre, because the Old Vic Theatre had been bombed during the war, and they had to find a new home, and it was the New Theatre. And I used to queue up there and get a seat in the Gods. So I saw King Lear and other marvellous plays in that company. That was a sort of resurrection that took place after those 19 months of blanking out. But then, Demob Day came, and this trauma continued, because I went home and a sort of lethargy descended on me, you know. It's very difficult. I mean, Churchill himself used to suffer these terrible depressions, which he called black dog. And I'm sure that's I had my share of black dog. In 1948, that was the bad year. The first few months back home, you see, it was just as though nothing had happened for the last 7 years. And I began to hate my family. I hated my town. I didn't want to meet any of the pre-war friends, and I just went into sort of, I'm not a physical disability, because I went on swimming, I spent much time as I could in the sea, I remember, and weeks and weeks, and then months and a month passed by, and my parents, of course, began to get exasperated. My hatred of everything and everybody grew, and happily for me, something snapped, and I packed my suitcase, jumped on a train, as millions of people have done in the past, and headed for London, you know. And suddenly I became immersed in London life. But I knew something was wrong with me, you know. This is an important thing. I just didn't descend into despair and suicide or anything like that, or contemplate it. But I knew there was something that I was sort of generally unhappy in. And I thought at that point I ought to seek advice. Now, I don't know who I went to. But unlike today, where there seem to be, you know, all kinds of institutions and official channels, as there should be, I don't know who I approached. But anyway, remarkably, I was sent about the most expensive place in the world, Harley Street. And therefore, for I don't know how much, but I mean something I could afford. And what was I earning? I'd taken a job as, I thought I'd want to get to know London. And I took a job with I went to the Labour Exchange after arriving in London. And immediately got a job. I said, what can you do? I said, well, I can fire weapons of different calibres and trucks of different sizes. So they looked up the file and said, well, there's a job with a transport company in the West End. So I took that. And that meant I was travelling all over London doing delivery jobs of one kind or another. At one point, I delivered a gardenia, was it, to Mrs. Attlee at 10 Downing Street, you know. And there were visits to Covent Garden Market and to the clothing trade in a sale time. I would drive to the East End and get these from the sweatshops in the East End. I'd get a truckload of clothing to deliver to Oxford Street, that sort of job. I went on for, I kept that job for about 3 months, and then I found the second-hand bookshop, which was this liberating event of my life. But I started to attend these Harley Street sessions, and it was a very friendly sort of patient lady who I just had to, you know, classic sort of psychiatric, just had to just sit there and lay there on the couch and just drift a bit like I'm drifting now. It must have helped, I suppose, because as I say, soon after I found this bookshop, put me on the right road, I met this charming young woman who became my wife, and here we are all these years later together. It's a happy marriage. So what a lucky man I've been, really, at the end of it all. But it was a bad time after the war, and I guess a lot of other guys had bad time, as they are having now, coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. I hate to think what those guys suffer afterwards. The ones who die perhaps are the luckier ones. I can believe that. I can't comprehend the mental suffering of after a war, what these two terrible wars that are still raging away.
To what extent was that the mental suffering addressed in any sort of official capacity after the war?
Well, I don't think I'm the person to ask, actually. Or am I? I mean, I was, somebody directed me. I must have approached some body or other who put me onto Harley Street, of all places. I mean, supposed to be the world's top doctors and specialists in Harley Street today. And there I was, going weekly for an hour or so, and just rambling away. It would need research in, you know, in the archives to discover what facilities there were, but I would guess it was nothing like today. I hope anyway that, I mean, they've just discovered a new sort of a label, haven't they, for soldiers who are suffering brain damage, with these awful roadside explosions create a tremendous impact on an armoured vehicle, and the brain gets a terrible bashing, and they find that soldiers have actually coming back. They're coming back with actual, not just sort of psychiatric or psychological problems, but brain damage problems. It's suddenly become a big problem, and these poor devils are coming back brain damaged. And that's not going to be put right very quickly. There's the cost of war for you. If only more people realise. Well, they don't. People retreat from the facts. Somebody said that people can only stand so much reality. They have to escape to an unreality of, you know, the world of consumerism. Keep buying, 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 and that means happiness. Well, it doesn't. As the suffering goes on.
Was there a general awareness of the fact that a lot of the service personnel had or might have psychological problems?
Yes. Well, the military mind, you know, I mean, just think what it was like in World War One. You're more likely to be, I mean, if you're in the gunners, you would have been strapped to a gun wheel overnight or something as punishment for your cowardice. And how many, I've got a book there about all the guys who were shot during the First World War for cowardice. Honestly, you know, what it was like to be in the trenches, men broke. They weren't cowards, they were just shattered by experience. And the officers put them on trial, and they were shot for cowardice. It's a terrible, terrible passage in history, British history, British stupidity, in British humanity. To soldiers, poorly. I think there's a book on my shelf all about that, those cases. So, Second World War, well, I think, there again, I'm no specialist knowledge, but I think battle fatigue took over from military cowardice, shall we say. It was recognised, and allowances were made. I don't think anybody was shot for cowardice in the Second World War. I hope not. There's always a reason for men. I scribbled some notes somewhere, I think, about what was cowardice. Cowardice, yes, I did. I've been scribbling lots of notes here, trying to dig into my memory. Anyway, I've got bravery, bravery, cowardice, and heroism. Bravery, yes, bravery is usually a young man's machoism. Well, the word macho, I don't think existed in World War II. It was bravado, really. We were simply all frightened in the war. You can't not be frightened, you know. But you hid it. So, what was that? Not bravery, heroism? Yeah. It's not cowardice. In my diary, I report a truly heroic act. I would say, yes, there was a hero. I'm not sure whether it was in our regiment, but we heard the story from an observation post came under heavy fire and caught a signaller unprepared, and his leg was blown off. At the same explosion, same shell, blinded the sergeant major. Now he was blinded. He heard the cries of this signaller for help, and he found his way to this wounded signaller, and the whole place was under shell fire. It was an observation post, and the enemy spotted them. And he rescued this wounded signaller and dragged him off to the safety of the house. Now, I would say that was a heroic act, definitely, wouldn't you? Definitely. Well done, Sergeant Major. You used to curse the Sergeant Majors. But that was a story that was certainly true, and I must have heard about it within a few hours of it happening. So it's there in my war diary. At least, there we are. We'd say it was a heroic act, but what was in the Sergeant Major's mind at that moment? It was a man crying for help. He didn't say, oh, I'm going to be a hero. He just found his way across the yard to this chap who was probably screaming in pain and then dragged him to safety. That's it. It was a comradely act. It wasn't heroism, really. But, of course, society labels an act like that heroic.
Were you immediately after the war, were you aware of the source of your low moods and depression?
It must have been just a lethargy, you know. A lethargy which I just couldn't take any sort of action. Because, I mean, for 5 years, I was the biggest motivation. You could have that just survival. And as I say, I had all these props going for me. I was really a very lucky soldier, when I look back. Very lucky. I mean, most guys just sort of resign themselves to being soldiers. And God knows how they dealt with the boredom. It's usually nothing but playing cards and games like housey-housey. And it's... I was lucky in having, the props, which then sort of not there for the last year or two. It was an existence. It's interesting. In my diary, I do make two prophetic remarks, which I dug out recently. Which is sort of a premonition of those 2 years, those last 2 years. May 3rd, 1945, I enter in my diary, war over in Italy. And then I add... I've lost my glasses. Oh, here we are. And then I had, and I'm thinking another 2 years in this army will kill me. Now, that's quite prophetic, isn't it? It almost did. And August the 1st, our pointless existence continues. Now, there are two little clues there. So that sort of blank hole in my life that followed, the mystery of the black hole. It was the fact that the clock seemed to turn back, you see. All the war experience didn't add up to anything suddenly. I thought I wasn't equipped for civilian life because, as I say, all I'd learned to do was be a soldier and survive as a soldier. Now, why I didn't take up photography, I do not know. I've discovered somewhere a little clipping which offered a photographic training. Then why didn't I follow that up? Is another big question mark. Why didn't I buy myself out of the army? I've got another letter showing that I, in fact, did write to some army department, and they sent back a letter saying, given the conditions under which I could buy myself out of the army at the end of the end of the war. There we are. So I knew about photography course, and about I could have bought myself out of the army. Why the bloody hell did I stay in it? That is extraordinary. All these years, this mystery has sort of evaporated from my mind. I'm having to cope with it now, all these years later. Oh, it's ludicrous, really.
There wasn't any question then of making a full career of service in the army. There wasn't any question of making a full career of army service.
Oh, no, no. I, in the army, it's quite evident in my diaries, I had no desire for promotion. I avoided any job. The officers once or twice approached me and said, Gray, we'd like you to go on this course. And I'd say, what course? He would say, I forgot what it was called now. It's a special course which was in fact a sort of surveying course because operating guns you need... Oh dear, I've forgotten the term. You need to have surveying... The site has to be surveyed before the guns arrive and positions are all mapped out. And you have to know the mathematics of it, and there's a basic instrument that you use. Is it a theodolite? I don't know, I've forgotten. That didn't appeal to me. One, I said, sorry, sir, I'm no good at maths. But it would have been promotion, you see. You could get to Lance Bombardier and Bombardier and Sergeant quite quickly if you were good. Now, this is another thing, an example of the stupidity of the way the army was run. I volunteered in 1940. The recruiting sergeant said, oh, you're just the kind of guy you want, you know, something like that. And from then on, the army military machine got me and processed me and went on processing me for the next 5 years. At the very end of it, in Woolwich Barracks, on the notice board said, intelligence testing session. And there was my name, Gunner Gray, 949621. So I turn up for this intelligence testing the last few weeks in the army. Can you believe it or not? So I had this intelligence test, and of course it was child's play, and top marks. And the officer undertaking this absurd ritual. Gray, why aren't you an officer? Why aren't you an officer? I said, oh, I never wanted to be an officer, so thank you very much. And it was true. It was true. Because I had a thing about intelligence testing, you know, It's a real chip on my shoulder about it, because it was brought in by Professor Burt. I'm not sure whether I've told you this, but when I was 14, we had examinations, and usually I was top one or two or three in examinations. I enjoyed examinations, no problem for me. But then suddenly, we were told that we were required to go for an intelligence test. Now, the intelligence test took place in an entirely different town, in Lewes in Suffolk. I was in school in Hove. I mean, travel then wasn't like it is today. So I went with my father. My father took me on the train to Lewes, and then we went to a strange school, strange surroundings, and sat at a table, and suddenly appeared in front of us these puzzling questions. We'd never been put at school, nothing like it had been put before us. So a whole generation of young kids then were denied further education. You're just baffled by what you saw, and I'd failed. Now, Professor Burt, after the war, was exposed as a total fraud. And if you find out, more about him, you'll be amazed what he got away with. He'd actually foisted this intelligence testing program on the government by cooking the books. The only other help he had was his secretary. She was totally involved in these fraudulent tests, which fooled the government of the day. It's hard to believe now, isn't it? But he was totally and utterly discredited after the war. And I was so pleased. I really was. I'm amazed I can't find any clippings, news clippings. So promotion is never entered my mind. Never wanted to boss other people around. My wife laughs when I say that, because she said, "Oh yes, you ran Hammersmith Books, you know, you didn't boss people around, you know." No, but it's true. I just didn't want to be. Over and over again in my diary, you come across this passage. I prefer to be with the lads, you know. The officers kept winkling me out and putting me on other jobs. And I was, very often I would say, no, sir, thanks, I want to stay with the lads. That shows up in my diary, that I just didn't want any different from the other guys, really. It's interesting, looking back. But no desire for promotion. Certainly not to be an officer. Thank you very much.